Heyo, it's another edition of We Talk Comics. This is our big, giant 75th anniversary episode, which is We Talk Comics gets all dressed up with No Place for Mo. That title right there is just kind of a hint that we're not going to be joined by Mo. We're also not going to be joined by our regular Chris. So we have a fake Chris. Chris, Comic Canuck, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you. We do have our regular person, Keith, over there, Cub Reporter K.
Getting the last news stories together, the breaking news, making sure I'm up to date. Just opening up Comicosity right now.
Oh, fantastic. And speaking of Comicosity, Keith, thank you for that excellent segue. I would love to introduce the brilliant, senior managing editor,
Senior editor, yeah.
Senior editor, excellent. Matt Centauri Griffith, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back. Always a huge pleasure.
Well, you know, and I was tempted to say Griffin, just, you know, to give a little shout out to Mo, but I decided to go with the correct way.
Matt really sold his enthusiasm there.
Yeah. Just gotta throw out Griffin, but if you're gonna do that, then I'm just gonna have to say Booster Gold.
Well, you took care of that really quickly, so now Keith doesn't have to mention it. Excellent. This is that's very good. So this episode, we're actually going to talk about costumes. Best, worst, craziest, wackiest. We have a whole bunch of guests that are going to come on, so we're going to drop some recordings in later on. But for now, there is something that we usually do. And, all right, who knows the most about Comicosity here?
Well, theoretically, that should be me, but, I don't know. But I'll take it and go with it.
Wax poetic.
So, I have been informed that We Talk Comics, the news section, is sponsored by this website called Comicosity, which I have some involvement with. And, as much as you guys love us, I think we love you more. So it's the best place to get your news, reviews, lots of interviews, just general good features, some by Keith, some by Brett. And we're more than thrilled to be able to feature We Talk Comics.
All right. Well, since I think it's that time, Keith, the weekly news with Cub Reporter Phil.
All right. Top news this week, Booster Gold is back. Yay!
Oh, I thought that Matt had kind of covered off on that, but damn.
We got the first chapter of the Smallville Digital First. The storyline is called Argo. It is 9 parts. It'll be broken up by a couple of parts of a shorter story. So it'll take a couple months for this story to all play out, but it is a Booster Gold, Supergirl, Legion of Superheroes story. And Matt's giving a little cheer. Remember that this is an audio podcast.
This is directed by Ben Affleck.
I don't want to interrupt you. I'm just,
Well, that would be a first. Then you would be the first official guest to not try to interrupt Keith.
I want to make sure that it's 100% clear that Matt is a guest host this week.
That's right. Absolutely.
This was he was a little chuffed that Jessica was called a guest host and he was only a guest. Now Duker, you're just a guest.
Hey, I didn't even get a website show yet, jerks.
We've also seen the cover of All-Star Western number 19 has finally been revealed, and our friend Chris Beck was correct. Despite the change of glove color, that is Booster Gold. That is in the 1800s with Jonah Hex. That issue is out next week, final week of the WTF covers.
Now, are we sure that it's Booster Gold in the 1800s and not Jonah Hex in the 21st century? I heard both.
I think the art... I believe the arc will involve time travel. There was a hint from Palmiotti a month or so ago on Twitter that a back and forth I had with him that we might be seeing something of the dystopic post-apocalyptic hex referenced in All-Star Western. So can't wait to see what happens with this, but we do know that Hex will show up in the 20th century in some way in the next couple issues.
Well, if they do reference Hex, then that would actually get me interested in the series.
When that happens, can we just go to the new 26?
It's a DC implosion. Everything that's old is new again.
Yeah.
All right, the Peter Panzerfaust motion comic that Curtis Weeb had talked to us about a couple of months ago, the audio has been recorded for us. For them? For us. Well, it is for us. Just for me. So the surprise is that they have several very recognizable names attached to this project. Voices will include Elijah Wood, Summer Glau, and Ron Perlman.
Holy crap. That's great.
So Perlman is Hook, and Elijah Wood is Peter. And also, Dante Basco was on the list. I don't recognize the name, but that is in the works now. And just late breaking, Rachel Rising has been optioned for TV by Lloyd Levin, producer of Watchmen and Hellboy, and also Ben Roberts, who has been a consultant on Walking Dead, will be producing.
Go Terry Moore.
So for those people who got that, Rachel Rising, I think, sells about, 1,500 copies? Walking Dead number one will seem overproduced compared to Rachel Rising number one. So if you got one of those, better slap that right now.
Well, and you heard the good news.
Slap what? Say it.
Ouch. You heard the good news about the last issue of Peter Panzerfaust too, right? That sales actually, I believe, doubled between issue 1 and 10.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Unbelievably amazing. It's really excellent.
It was so good of all those people to listen to our podcast and, with Curtis when he came on and, therefore go out and buy it. I have to give myself a pat on the back for that.
That's the We Talk Comics bumper right there.
Yep, that's right.
5,000 copies. Money in the bank. Yeah, it's incredible for a comic that came so close to being canceled. They really put in the work. Curtis went nonstop. Every interview that he could do, every podcast, even hours. And push this and really got the attention, so it's fantastic. What else do we got? We've got Greg Pak's Kickstarter, Code Monkey Save World. Graphic novel based on the songs of Jonathan Coulton, written by Greg Pak and drawn by Takeshi Miyazawa. That's my best guess. As I look at this right now, the project was just launched 2 days ago and is currently at $108,000 out of its $39,000 goal. So they're probably okay with it when we talk comics from.
We can't hurt.
They're going to go over 200,000 because of the We Talk Comics bump, though. So.
I now want to see what the extras are that got them there that fast.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Curtis Weeb, who will be at C2E2 in Chicago next week, and Matt, you get to say hello to him in person.
I will definitely try to do that.
He has announced, after the couple of teaser images we've seen, the comic that is coming out of those is called Rat Queens. This is there'll be more details released at C2E2. And then we got the Eisner Award nominations. Man, I had no idea there were this many categories in the Eisner Awards until you you start digging through. We'll just hit out a couple of highlights. Best new series, Adventure Time, Bandettes, Fatale, Hawkeye, Saga. Best continuing series, Fatale, Hawkeye, Manhattan Projects, Prophet, and Saga. Matt, what was it you said about the overview of this?
Generally, I mean, no superhero comics except Hawkeye, but I don't really consider Hawkeye a superhero comic. I love it, though, but yeah, it's not really a superhero comic. Oh, but actually, that's not true. Batwoman got 2 nominations.
All right. And that's the news.
Well, I do have one thing I want to add. It was really for Mo's benefit, but since he's not here, he'll have to hear about it late. So in the interview that went live, I should say today, but really, let's say Wednesday, on Comicosity with J.M. DeMatteis about Phantom Stranger and also his new series coming up, Lar Flees, he announced first time, this Comicosity exclusive, that if Phantom Stranger number 10 will see the return of a much-beloved DC character to the new DC universe, and that would be Grant Morrison creation from the pages of JLA, Zoriel, the angel who replaced Hawkman and the team. So there is still hope for Mo's Hawkman Corps after all.
Wow. Well, we've been wondering what Pete Tomasi's going to do after Green Lantern Corps. I think Hawkeye Corps is the perfect follow-up.
Yeah.
Hawkman Corps. Oh, I crisped that one up.
Hawkeye Corps. Yeah.
That's quite the bell.
The only thing better than Hawkman Corps would be Hawkeye Corps.
Because it would be one guy. What a corps.
Well, two, technically.
They eventually just need to start melding all these characters together and give them all rings and be done with it. Superman, right. Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern. That's it.
More rings. I don't know why DC hasn't gone with that one right now.
I'm still looking for the Earth ring, the brown ring. The white rings, meh.
Yeah, the brown ring might not sell as well as
is there like a, can we do fuchsia and all these wonderful, brilliant colors?
Fuchsia.
All right, well, speaking of fuchsia, what a fantastic segue into our actual topic. yes.
Yeah, I'd be real suspicious that you invited me to guest host this week, since we're talking about fashion, except that I practically begged to be on, so.
Well, given that we are all fashion plates here.
Thank God this is recording.
Yeah, we know absolutely nothing about fashion. So, well, Matt, since you were very excited about coming on, why don't you start off this topic for us?
Sure. What kind of stuff do you want to know? I mean, I jotted down a little list of some stuff. I mean, I definitely have some all-time favorite hero costumes, like stuff that just, you know, and actually looking at the list, they're all pretty similar. And, you know, first and foremost, honestly, the original Alpha Flight costumes. They are, I mean, no joke, they are like some of the coolest, streamlined, clean design costumes you've ever seen in a comic book.
You're my best friend now.
That's the black and
white. I love Alpha Flight.
That's the black and white ones, is that what you mean?
Yeah, oh, all of them, really, though. Like Snowbirds and Auroras and North Stars and I guess the Guardians and all that. I mean, I actually bought the Alpha Flight action figures, mostly just because I like the costumes. Because I still haven't actually read the comics, even though I have them on the shelf.
What?
Sorry. Well, I mean, I own them. I've put my money in.
Well, yeah. I guess I got that feeling. I have 300 comics sitting behind me that I haven't read yet. So.
Yeah. Well, I did read them in X-Men. I just haven't read their series.
Mm-hmm. Which series? You know, I do hope for your sake that you don't have more than the first one.
I think I have 2 volumes or 3 of John Byrne's in trade.
Yeah, that's fair. That's,
Keith,
that's
are
fair.
We falling into this whole it's an audio, video, visual thing now again?
Yeah.
We'll see if you don't talk about it, you don't draw attention to I'll tweet this photo later. I have the off-plate mini-mates that I picked up at San Diego Comic-Con. So it's North Star, Marina, Puck, and Guardian in this set. And someday when I buy stuff again, I want to track down the other. There's another matching set that was done at New York Comic Con that has Snowbird, Sasquatch, and whoever the other two are. Aurora, you know, and there's only seven. I don't
please
know.
Burn your passport. Just burn it.
What about Vindicator?
You bastard.
Would Vindicator get it? Well, but that'd make the second set three women and Sasquatch, which seems
yeah,
like,
yeah, it would.
Probably not, yeah.
So it's, I mean, hey, what about Sasquatch? Shaman? Oh, Shaman. Yeah, yeah, that'd be who it is, yeah. Hey!
I know my Alpha Flight.
It's name your, little quick round of name all the members of Alpha Flight.
Right. But no, like, their costumes are totally cool and not an outside underwear in the bunch. And that's the thing, like, none of the costumes that I really, really love on superheroes ever had that outside underwear. So when the new 52 just, like, went away with it, it didn't bother me at all.
See, they're all Canadian, though, so they actually are wearing underwear, but it's long underwear. That's why there's no...
Well, no,
live up to the stereotypes, sir, Keith.
They're all in onesies.
Okay, but, like, Kid Flash, the original Kid Flash, that's another costume I just love, 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 love. Even though it was yellow, I still loved it.
You know, I think that that you're going to have some competition with, well, not competition, but agreement with that, because I'm pretty sure that Mo was going to add Kid Flash to his list.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's like, it is the Silver Age standard. And probably designed by Carmine Infantino.
Did Kid Flash always have the hair out? Was it always like a no-top?
His first costume was just a smaller version of Barry's, so then no.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Once he took on the yellow costume, he always had it out. And originally, he dyed his hair brown to disguise his identity, and then he just let it go red.
I have a costume that I hate. It's two on the same hero, if you can even call him a hero, because I've hated this character since the moment he was brought into the Marvel Universe to, I don't know where the hell he is now, but I swear to God, if they come up with his own series, I'll burn Marvel to the ground. Just kidding, of course. Is Speedball. Speedball with all his just, like, I think one yellow, like, onesie with a bunch of glowing balls all around him was pretty much his costume. And pretty much the extent of the kind of hero he was, which was total crap. And then he eventually morphed into, as we all may recall or may not if we're smart, after Civil War, had a costume made for him, which was more like a suit of armor with a bunch of nails, that if he used his powers, they'd all dig into him, and he was called Penance. Quite bad. Quite bad.
Oh, God, that was I just read those over the summer. Those are so bad.
Yeah, that was his S&M costume, which was totally works with Speedball, really.
Yeah.
The essence of Speedball.
It's just M at that point, though, isn't it? it's not S and M, I think.
Yeah. It's Speedball and M.
You know? I never read it. Is that what House of M is about?
No. Yes, it is.
House of M is actually very good.
I must have read a different sense. House of M.
That does make sense. Scarlet Witch always kind of had that happening anyway.
You know, it's funny, I was just about to say, another one I had on my list was Scarlet Witch. One costume that I never liked, but I love it because of the fact that Marvel has the guts to stick with it through all these years. Pretty much still a very similar costume after all this time. As campy as it looks. And good for them for keeping it.
Well, the one thing is, though, I don't like her new thing with Marvel now, where she's wearing, like, a jacket and a dress and pants. I'm like, pick something. Like, you don't need all three.
Pick nothing.
I mean, in New York, you probably don't have to dress in layers the whole year round.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, if she was a member of Alpha Flight, then it would be different.
Right, that would make sense.
But when the humidity hits this summer in New York, it's, you know, she's going to be way too much.
I love that Dukers was hassling me for playing to the Canadian stereotype of it being cold, and we had like 4 inches of snow last weekend. Yeah.
This is our spring.
It's all gone now, but we had 4 inches of snow on Saturday.
It wasn't 4 inches. It was more like two. plus two.
I live on the edges of town. It was more like six.
Oh.
The inner city is different. I'm gonna say one of my least favorite original costumes and least favorite Marvel Now costumes is the same character. It's Hulk.
See, I knew
the purple pants. The Hulk's purple pants. And then, who has kept up on Hulk? Who has read any of the issues of Hulk and can explain to me why he's wearing armor? Because it's now become a gag line in other books.
I'm an issue behind, but I don't know if they even explained it yet, and if they have, I've forgotten. And I'm about to drop the book, so.
It was used as a gag line in one of the X-Men books a couple of weeks ago, where one of the characters kind of like says it as an aside. Why is the Hulk wearing armor? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, actually, it's funny because I'm not hearing, because Mo was mentioning to me today that that he was thinking of giving up on the Hulk. So I'm actually going to have to catch up on the Hulk, perhaps just so that I can give up on the Hulk.
You will.
I'm scared now, so I don't know where to go.
I only read the first issue, and it just wasn't for me. But it also had a big art change, didn't it, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I dropped Captain America as well, by the way, since we're on the note of dropping books.
Oh. I'm really digging this story.
I don't hate it, but I just predict it's going to be the same old shit in the end, and we're going to be like, oh, what was the whole point of that? So I dropped it before I get to that point.
So what are your guys' attitudes about the Captain America costume Marvel Now? About it being more Ultimate-y?
I don't mind it, actually.
I actually like it. Harder to draw, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I've seen a few notes about those, and particularly the New 52 stuff from artists who are, you know, tired of drawing that many scenes on everything. Yeah, and that cap costume, that's a fiddly detailed kind of costume. There's so much. I did wonder if maybe that's why in Cap's own book the costume's so destroyed, so Romita doesn't have to draw as much of it.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, it's interesting because the general rule for Captain America, I prefer the iconic take of the original costume. But as I read the book, maybe because it's in tatters, but I don't hate the look of it, and I think it'll be interesting when he does. I'm not caught up on Captain America, but when he does get back into it, and when I do see it in the Avengers, then it's not bad. It's not the original look, but
does he currently have the A or not? The A on the forehead. It comes and goes. I know. You know, the Heroes Reborn costume had an eagle instead of the A. Oof.
No, it's got to be the A.
Yeah, the eagle was bad, though. The eagle just looks stupid. Thank you, Rob Liefeld. Thank you.
A costume that I can't stand, and it's been around forever, are the Guardians of the Universe. They're little robes. Just like, come on. Really? That's all I got.
They're body conscious. That's all.
Yeah. And they're blue.
They have little pot bellies.
I want to get mixed up with Smurfs.
Yeah, well, and look how attractive the Smurfs are in those little pants with no shirts. I mean, it doesn't really exude authority.
There's the best crossover that we have not seen. Is the Smurfs and the Guardians of the Universe.
Yes. Man, that Guy Gardner is Smurfy.
So, Atrocitus just comes in and walks over all of them.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, no, I really, really have always hated Firestorm. Oh. I think there's way too much going on in that costume. Like, there's no easy icon. He's got, like, puffy sleeves and... It's way too much. That was like New 52 long before the New 52.
I think puffy sleeves should be like the death knell of any single costume. Puffy sleeves are the single, I think maybe the single worst addition to any costume you could ever add.
Yeah, I think the explanation for that was given was that it would show that he's flying, because the sleeves would, you know, wave in the wind. Except his hair is on fire, so wouldn't that just...
Yeah, you would think that touch would take care of the business.
If only there was a way to quickly indicate.
Because they didn't want to give him a cape. I guess that's the deal. So,
yeah, one of my one of the costumes that came up for me when I was thinking about this, and it's interesting because I wound up just ordering the first omnibus. 600 pages of Grendel, the Hunter Rose Grendel, and I thought that the actual that Grendel costume really stood out to me because it was an interesting mixture of ninja and just nice clean black and white and I thought it really works.
Well, it's like Spider-Man too, the black Spider-Man costume. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys all remember when that came out, and I'm sure you were all reading comics then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big deal. That was an awesome costume. Again, that was another action figure that I probably wouldn't have bought, except, yeah, the awesome costume.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, how many characters are there that have been able to have not one iconic costume, but two iconic costumes that are actually almost equally beloved by fans? Because I know that for me, I love both Spider-Man costumes.
Yeah, I'm with you there, too. Obviously, being huge Spider-Man fans, and into the new, like now, like when you've got Scarlet Spider series, which believe it or not, I'm still reading, and I actually am quite enjoying, even though I hated the Clone Saga years and years and years ago. I don't mind Scarlet Spider's costume; looks pretty cool.
Well, but that original one was terrible.
I had Agent Venom down as well. As one of my favorite designs, taking the iconic Spider-Man, Venom, and then strapping on some gun belts to it, I thought it was an interesting. I thought it was a really cool take to really kind of play with that iconic image and then make it unique at the same time.
Yeah. How about Aunt May's costume, a dress and a cardigan? Man, she could rock that.
Yeah.
And has for 400 years.
Now, Aunt May is someone who should be wearing layers.
That bitch just won't die, seriously. Like, just saying.
Well, she keeps getting younger and younger.
Yeah, I know, which is impressive.
She's going to be Peter Parker's sister eventually.
I've decided that the Marvel maybe Marvel Universe actually takes place over the timeline that the comics came out. But the average life expectancy in the Marvel Universe is 175 years. You know, if everyone's just, they're 60 and they just look like that.
It could be different physics, I guess. I don't know.
I've read, almost a dozen issues of All New X-Men. I still don't understand what year they came from. So they came from far enough back that cell phones are a disturbing, mysterious force.
I thought they were.
Cyclops was very thrown off by cell phones in one of the early issues, so I'm not exactly sure how far back they're supposed to have come from.
I mean, to be fair, that could be like 10 years. I mean, for, handheld cell phones.
Oh, and the price of coffee, I think, was... coffee shops, I think, was something else that threw them off. Fancy coffee.
It's got to be longer than 10 years then.
I've always really liked Mystique's costume. It just worked with her personality and still does to this day, even though she can change her form at any time. I think they married it well with who she is, and it's always stuck, like that white with the gold clasp and the red hair and everything, right? It's nice. Mm-hmm.
The little skull belt.
Mm-hmm. And also some would say her form. And then there... Excuse me for a minute.
I really like... speaking of the X-Men in that case, I love Dark Phoenix. I love the fact that they took the same costume, changed the colors, and it instantly became, again, like just something iconic and something so, easily associated with that character.
Mm-hmm. That is that's one of the scenes that isn't quite as dramatic when you read it in the black and white essential
action. That's
very, very true. Yes. Yeah, because you're so excited, I think, as you're reading it, you're just like, oh, they're going to introduce Dark... Oh, Black and White Phoenix. Okay.
Time to break out the crayons.
Well,
I'll never get that shiny look.
I've always loved Magneto's costume. He just looks evil, and you don't want to mess with that guy. But until now, his white costume is horrible.
What have they done to Magneto?
You know, I don't mind the white. Because I like that he's in white and the White Queen's in black.
It's like Kyle Rayner came through and met up with Axis and said, hey, take me to your universe. And they came over and said, here's a white ring. See ya.
Although, in fairness, this will look great in the Essential versions in 25 years.
That's right. 25 years when we're retired and
still just reading the same comics. Room staring at each other.
I do love Cyclops' new costume, though. Especially, like, with the X in the center of his face. I think that's super cool.
Yeah, that was a nice evolution there.
It's funny, when I saw that in the Marvel Now, that first Marvel Now promo image that they put out that had all new design characters, it was the one I liked the least. And I think it's probably, you know, aside from maybe Captain America, it's the one I like the most now.
There's still a moment of it looking like he has a starfish stuck on his face, but
it's a bit Starro, yeah. But that's for Matt. That's a good thing. Matt being a gigantic Justice League fan, an echo of Starro, not the worst thing.
Nope, not the end of the world.
But it works. It works. I like it plays to the character. I think they've integrated that well into what that character's up to. But speaking of faces, I'm going to say that the question is one of my all-time favorite looks. The simplicity of it, I actually first encountered the question in Charlton Bullseye. It was a question story and a Blue Beetle story. In one issue. That was the first time I'd even before they were bought by DC, I had this one loose issue that I got from wherever. And I was so taken with the way that the character, the chemical that affixed the mask to his face also changed the color of his suit. So it was more of a costume rather than, you know, just the mask, which is where Denny O'Neil went with it.
I'm with you there. It's very cool. It just works perfectly with what his name is. So many things. So many good things about it.
Oh, easily. In the 80s, he became one of my favorite characters the second that I saw him with, you know, with the Cowan and O'Neill run. I mean, it was just fantastic to just the fact that he didn't have a face.
Well, and even when they took the character after 52... and changed the identity over to Rene Montoya. Just, I think the way that the different artists, particularly Cully Hamner, was able to work with just, you know, like different outfits that she would wear, but no matter what she was wearing, that having that no face always just like defined her perfectly.
So is there any characters then that started off with terrible costumes, but then they absolutely got it right afterwards?
That's a good question.
I mean, I might suggest Daredevil is that, because I'm just not that big a fan of the all-yellow costume, the yellow and red costume. I like the red costume quite a bit, but the yellow one didn't really work for me.
Spider-Man had the webbed underarms when he first appeared, didn't he?
Yep.
Those were part of the original design, weren't they?
Yeah, I think they were Ditko.
Yeah, I would say I'd let less dramatic than Daredevil, but I would say that was an improvement. The water wings, whatever they were supposed to do.
Since we're on the Spider-Man kick, I would say Electro. Electro, campy villain with the, you know, electricity head, star head, and now he's just, he doesn't have that. It does actually make a big difference. I think I find him more of a menacing villain than a joke villain.
He doesn't have that anymore?
No, it's all kind of, it looks like it's actually being kind of like plastered down on the cowl kind of thing.
What?
So like I think it's a good move on Marvel's part. I like where they took it. So
yeah, I can't really think of anyone that evolved that much. I mean, there have been like little tweaks here and there, or maybe like someone who's had two costumes and I like the second one better. But I don't know.
I think about.
Actually, I have one, but this ties into another thought. Is my biggest guilty pleasure costume from when I was a kid, but this definitely applies here, where someone started off with a pretty tacky costume and it finally got better, is Nightwing.
Huh.
Now, I love the disco Nightwing outfit, and if I had my way, I would have had one for Halloween as a kid, but my mom never got around to make me one, which is probably all for the better. But yeah, I think now with, you know, pretty much streamlined, a lot better, not so crazy. You did have the Booster Gold, the big collar.
Yeah, he had the pop collar, yeah.
Yeah.
Collars are not a very good idea either in superhero costumes.
But he combined that with the open chest, which was super popular. So, but at least he didn't have bare legs anymore. So,
yes, I mean the Robin costume. Even I mean, like with all the changes that have gone through the Robin costume, the idea of the little pixie boots that.
Tim Drake's costume was so dramatic when first introduced. Yeah, because Jason essentially had Dick Grayson's costume, right? I don't think they had really changed much. I think the boots had changed a little bit, but they were so superficial compared to the introduction of I don't know who actually designed that costume. Tom Wiles, who I remember drawing it kind of early on, but I don't know who actually designed it. Could be Tom Wiles.
It could be. Well, and just remember, that was the original internet. Well, it wasn't internet at the time, but it was the original debate about putting pants on characters. So, yeah, it was pretty dramatic.
Well, speaking of evolution of costumes, and this sort of ties in, and it's more of a time thing. But even actually, if you look at even all new X-Men now, I'm talking about Iceman. From where Iceman was as this sort of snowman-type Iceman character from the 60s to now this hard-edged, solid-looking hero. Like, that's his costume, the ice, right? But there is a distinct evolution there of where he was and where he is now, and it's kind of cool to see them beside each other. And I love how Marvel is, you know, sticking to those styles, for sure. Like, this is what Iceman was. This is what he is now. So it's, you can really tell them apart. I like the evolution of it, even though it's not technically a costume.
I don't really like the fact that he's got so many things popping out of him now. Like, that part just doesn't seem to work for me, because it doesn't seem like as a costume, it doesn't seem like it's useful in any way. I like the angular, you know, like tight, close to the body ice look, because I thought that made perfect sense. But all this, like, oh, look at me, I've got spikes. Really? How does that help?
Well, I think it's part of that evolution out of, you know, the 90s, where everyone had pouches and jackets and spikes.
Thank you, Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, I mean, and whatever else you could add. And there's a little bit of that now, obviously, but yeah, I don't really get that either. I've never been quite fond of that. I'm not fond of, you know, like the Elder Angel's long hair either. So there's.
I have a question for you guys. Favorite villain costume of all time?
I think Doctor Doom might be mine. I love the fact that there's a lot that you can do with it. Like, it's, I love the look of the original one, but I also am a fan of the update for 2099 that they gave him for, you know, the better part of the 2099 run. And so it's one of those cases where you can kind of go updated, but you don't have to, and it works really well.
Keith? We've already talked about Magneto, which would probably be my number one. My number two is probably Doctor Doom. I feel like I need to add a DC villain in here somewhere.
Lex Luthor in his green and purple armor.
That is pretty cool.
Business suit Lex Luthor was one of my favorites, actually, because it was so different than purple and green Luthor. The suit and tie Lex Luthor. He was so much scarier as that character than he was as the green and purple evil scientist.
As long as it's not Sinestro with like in the early days with the like little pixie-esque costume going on.
How is that
scary?
I have one though. I really love the Silver Age Catwoman outfit, the purple dress with the green cape.
Yeah.
I just I miss that a lot. I mean the black suit is fine, it's great, whatever, but you know, it would totally kill just to see her in one issue in a purple dress like that. Like that would be awesome.
I've got since I did say Magneto, and I agree with Keith, he's my number one, but I actually, for DC, I have to go with the Joker, you know, just for, it's
like the purple suit?
It's literally insane, yeah. It's
purple. Like
the embodiment.
Purple, everything.
Insane.
Purple and green?
Yeah. And,
what was it with purple and green now that I think about it? Mixie's Pedelec was purple and green.
Wasn't he purple and orange?
Is he purple and orange? I thought it was purple.
I feel like it was purple and orange. The first one was purple and green, Golden Age, and then Silver Age was orange and purple.
Yeah.
They just wanted to get away from that purple and green, you know, color scheme.
Purple man. There's
purple man.
Skin and suit all purple.
Hawkeye.
I actually, before you go on, Chris, I will say, Time Trapper, one of my favorite looks, and I was just talking to someone the other day about the character because they were asking, wasn't it revealed who the Time Trapper really was? And I'm like, yeah, but they've rebooted the Legion of Superheroes like three times since then. So, and it was in 0 hour. I don't think anyone's really going back to that as source material.
Either. Holy shit, I remember that now.
Well, it was Cosmic Boy in 0 hour, but it was Superboy Prime in the last universe, wasn't it?
Was it really?
Yeah.
I missed that beat.
Wow.
My other one is Apocalypse. Because you just look at him and you're like...
Do you like Apocalypse when he's kind of like taller, you know, the way that Simonson drew him, or do you like kind of the more squat Age of Apocalypse, almost square design?
No, I like the tall, like... menacing, I'm going to fuck you up look.
The guy with the big A on his chest?
Yeah, like, you just know it. You're like, you're not going to mess with him. It's like, that A target's there for a reason, so you can jump in and he can kill you.
I love that he's a 3,000-year-old Egyptian with a giant A on his chest.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I will crush anyone who gets in my way. You will remember me by, you know, the A. God.
No. Actually, I have one. Brainiac, the Silver Age Brainiac.
I love him
because
you mean the green and purple Brainiac?
Green and pink.
The green and pink.
He's the only, probably one of the few characters, except maybe Star Sapphire, that wore pink. Cosmic Boy, which is another one of my guilty pleasures, is Cosmic Boy's like 1970s bustier costume. Where all he was wearing was like the black bustier. It's awesome.
I think Brett has that costume at home.
Wears it to Rocky Horror Night.
Yes. When Cosmic Boy was cosplaying as himself.
Yes, I'm sure he called it cosplaying.
Now, there are some characters that have costumes that are basically unbreakable. Batman has 1,000 versions of that costume. I love the Flashpoint version. There were so many Elseworlds versions. Some characters never get it right. And off the top of my head, I've got friends that adore this costume, the classic costume, and I think that the classic costume has that that it's better as a memory than it was as at the time. Dazzler.
It's knocking disco today.
We got disco Dazzler, and we've got blue onesie with the bandana Dazzler.
Terrible.
Oh man,
onesie's awful. It makes me sad every time to think that she's not wearing a pantsuit and roller skates. And face makeup. You've got to have the face makeup. No, seriously. Like, if you're going to have a character called Dazzler, just do it.
I have a friend who's in roller derby, and that is her costume for roller derby, including the face makeup.
Allison Blair doesn't have to be disco. She could be roller derby, and it would still work.
You know, I have to agree, actually, with the face makeup. Because I actually found myself, I was reading a ton of books, and at one point, and then Dazzler shows up, and I'm reading it going, who the hell is this character?
Right?
And I'm like, oh, it's Dazzler. I didn't even recognize her.
Well, and that's the problem with when you take someone that has a problematic costume, and then, and I'm using air quotes for those that don't see that on the podcast right now, and then try to, like, make it more modern. It's not like, you know, there were all those costumes I really loved, Alpha Flight, Spider-Man, Black Spider-Man, etc. And all those, because they're very, very simple, but they were designed to be simple, whereas I feel like Dazzler's costume was designed to replace something that was already, like, really cool. I think Power Girl had the same problem. Like, her costume was fine, and then they gave her some weird gold thing, and then some blue and white thing with a headband, and then they brought her back to the original costume.
I forgot about that Justice League Europe era Power Girl costume. I forgot all about that.
Who hate the costume she's been wearing now, shut up about it. She was wearing a gold costume with a turtleneck for a while. Like, could we? I mean, let's be glad we didn't go back to that. All because people are like, oh no, she can't have, you know, a circle in the front of her costume.
Yeah, it's funny how some costumes just won't leave well enough alone. It's good. Okay, leave it. It is what it is. You can't fix it from here.
I mean, the good news is the Flash pretty much has always had the same costume since 1956. And yeah, it's been tweaked and whatever, but that is like a super classic costume.
Although that Jay Garrick Flash with the bowl on his head was always seemed a little weird.
Yeah, well, that was before that, yeah.
Do you think that thing would just heat up and just burn them? No.
Spin off and hit someone and slice their head off, yeah.
And he can just have dinner afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
What got that to his head? Like, There was no strap or anything.
Super science.
G-Force.
Super science. When I was a kid, I was watching a soap opera with my mom, and there was a woman with a strapless gown on. And I said, Mom, what holds that dress up? And my mom looked at me with a completely straight face and said, hope.
And we all know now it was tape.
Well, one costume that I definitely, there's two costumes that I want to talk about that are kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum for me. I would be remiss if I did not mention the NFL Super Pro costume on this show, because it was so fantastic. Actually, the idea of wearing a football helmet as a superhero is just amazing. But it's funny because I have a snowman Christmas ornament that has a football helmet on it, and it looks shockingly like the NFL Super Pro. So it's I don't think that's a good thing. But the other costume that I will say that I like is I like the Punisher costume because it's simple and it's easily transferable between different, you know, different media, you know, because you can have the comic where it looks spandexy, but you can have the comic where it doesn't look very spandexy. You can have the movies where it's literally spray painted on and stuff like that. And it's always the Punisher. It's always the skull on a black shirt. And you don't have to get much. It doesn't get much easier than that.
Yeah, I love the way that it was drawn in this last series that Rucker wrote. And yeah. I guess it was spray painted on, but it almost felt even like just like chalk dust on his shirt. It was awesome.
I'm with you there completely. You can't. It's hard to do an evolution of that costume, but when that last run came, like, holy crap, this is great. It was subtle. It was more subtle than it's ever been.
Yeah, well, Deadpool's got a nice color scheme and with the eye things. I mean, I like the fact that you can get it on a t-shirt. I actually think the stuff that you can get fun t-shirts out of makes a better costume overall.
So wait, isn't Deadpool's just sort of like Spider-Man's?
I mean, well, sure it is. Yep.
Yeah. I agree. That doesn't seem like a very.
It's not a very good costume, but I love the fact that it's instantly recognizable on a t-shirt.
Actually, I was at, where was I? I had my Deadpool shirt on one day at a store, and the Deadpool t-shirt is him like firing a couple of guns, so you don't see a whole lot of the costume, you just see the face. And the woman behind the counter said, "That's a really great Spider-Man shirt." And I chose to just let that one go.
That's
local man arrested. I was just trying to buy gum and she insulted my shirt. Yeah.
Well, another one of my favorite sort of costume related things was that moment when Grant Morrison had Animal Man start wearing a leather jacket. So the idea that this guy who gets his powers from animals is now wearing like dead hides on his back. And it was so cool. So as a kid, if I, you know, any superhero I ever could have imagined, you know, creating or being or whatever, it was going to be in just spandex with a leather jacket.
That's awesome. All right. Well, why don't we just go around? Any last thoughts from anybody before we go to our special guests?
Sure. I'll start. I tweeted Dan Jurgens a couple of weeks ago about, because I just reread Death of Superman not that long ago, and I asked if his intention was to have Booster kind of go fallow after he was done using him. He never answered that question, but he did say that he hated the Armored Booster run, and he just kind of went off on that, on a tangent of how much he hated that design and how glad he was that they finally got him back into a real costume again. And to me, you know, I mentioned this at the time when the new 52 launched. Booster's costume, it changed a lot. It's more of a, it's streamlined. The color scheme changed a little. The way that the star works and the color lines changed. But that Legion flight ring, that's the costume for me. They could change absolutely anything else on that costume, and as long as it's still a Legion flight ring. That is so core to the character for me.
Chris?
Well, this is going to be really obvious, but Superman's always been my favorite hero. It's the costume that even people who don't know comics like recognize immediately, and they will know even if they're completely out of touch. But I've always loved the Superman costume, except for the time when he turned electric blue, actually electric blue.
And red.
That was, dear God, don't give me, but, that's kind of my final take on costumes. So
I like that darker costume he had for a little while. After the time travel story, his costume got really dark.
Our world's at war when somebody died? I forget who died.
No, I think they made it a plot point that when he was traveling through time, his costume got darker, and they just put it on in a caption of, something strange happened to my costume as I'm traveling through time, and then they just left it that way.
The color is screwed up. Well, it's all right. Let's rate it.
We had a printer issue.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, Matt?
Speaking of traveling through time, I have to say that my favorite costumes pretty much of all time would be the Legion of Superheroes. I mean, mostly there were sort of reinventions in the 70s, and then when the real Legion was finally brought back around like Final Crisis or whenever it was, and Gary Frank was able to redesign all the costumes, and he brought most of them back to sort of these Bronze Age sort of iterations, but updated. I just thought that was so cool. And most of those are still around today, which is pretty awesome. But just seeing how characters like over 50 years can just have different costumes and is just very awesome. And Starboy especially. Like, again, another really awesome Starfield, very simple, white boots, clean, pretty cool.
Well, my favorite character, of course, is the Golden Age Sandman, and I love the look of the gas mask. It's I hate the look of the Sandman with the yellow and the red. I don't like that costume, but the Golden Age Sandman with the with the nice trench coat. Although there was the figure that I have actually is purple and green. It has purple and green suit underneath. So there we are again. But I love the gas mask, and I love the fact that it has changed a little bit over time. But it's a nice looking costume, and it's certainly nice to get drawn. I was thinking that with Eric Larson coming to the Calgary Expo, I would love to get Eric Larson to do my Golden Age Sandman. But if I get Eric Larson to do it, then I actually want him to draw on top of the hat. I want him to put a fin. Just because, you can't get Eric Larson to do something without a fin, I think. Next up, I think we're going to, what we'll do is we're going to say thank you to our friend Comic Canuck for coming on the show here. We certainly appreciate it. So why don't you give us some plugs, Chris?
Sure. So I'm Chris, otherwise known as Comic Canuck, co-owner, managing editor of comicbooktherapy.com. Fun little site, reviews, rants, interviews, all that good stuff. You can check us all out there. And definitely friends of these guys. We talk comics and fans of Comicosity as well. So thanks for having me on, and keep reading and have fun.
And then as far as everything else goes, well, I think we're going to drop in a whole bunch of our guests. That'll actually include our usual Chris. It'll include Mo, and it'll include a bunch of other Comicosity folks who have been kind enough to join us. So let's go to that.
Hey, guys. I hope you're having a good show. I'm Chris. I couldn't join you this evening, unfortunately. My day job prevents it, but I couldn't resist. I have to get a little podcasting in this week. I thought I'd just record some of my thoughts on costumes. The first beef I have with the costume is Wolverine. And I'm talking the yellow, blue, and black version. You know, the original X-Men Wolverine. I remember seeing Wolverine that first time, thinking, wow, a hero with claws. This guy's going to be badass. Yet the child in me never really went, wait a minute, this guy is wearing canary yellow. I don't know how Wolverine became such the standard for the bad guy hero. I mean, look at that costume. It's awful. It works because it's always worked, but wow. Yellow, blue, and black. And winglets on his helmet. I guess that's new and unique, but I have trouble with it. And I really wish somebody would have stood out a little sooner before it became the standard and said, P.S., this doesn't work. I much prefer his brown uniform. I like my heroes in costume, so definitely I have to go with the Chris Claremont brown costume from the limited series and his run on the X-Men. The yellow never has worked with me, but if you were going to ask me, should we get rid of it? No. I mean, it's been around 50 years or so. So I guess we have to have him drag that one out occasionally, I guess. But not my favorite. Costume number two. Moon Knight. Moonlight looks badass in the comic books. But from a logic level, wearing all white cape, all white Batman type suit. What, does the guy own a dry cleaners? This has to be most impractical crime fighting gear ever. I mean, this is what prevents Moon Knight from ever getting a movie. White? I mean, does he not go out after Labor Day ever? Bad costume. Impractical costume. This is kind of what gives comic books a bad name. It's like, sometimes we have to question some of this stuff. Third one, Wonder Man. Wonder Man's never had a good costume. They varied from what I feel is the worst costume of all time, and that's the green, red, and yellow costume introduced in West Coast Avengers. You know, the one where they moved the jetpacks from his waist to his shoulder blades? A costume so bad, they actually wrote it out of the comic book saying, yeah, my publicist didn't like it. Anyway, Weatherman has never had a costume. He's had the I'm a Hollywood guy producer type costume. That's never really played outside of the 80s. He's had the big W one, but really, he's never had a distinctive look. I'd love for somebody to come up with something, but it never has. And I'm actually in favor of a moratorium on Wonder Man until somebody comes in and fixes it. Maybe we could all vote on it, but this is a character that has, what, 8 or 9 costumes, and none of them have ever been any good. But that's just me, my thoughts on costumes. Until Comic Book Attractions, this is Chris. Have fun with the rest of the guys.
Hi, my name's Gavin Craig. I'm a reviewer for Comicosity, and I've been asked about my favorite comic book costumes of all time. If you read any comic books at all, you realize pretty quickly that in superhero comics, the way costumes work has very little to do with the way actual clothing works. I started reading comics in the early 90s, which was probably one of the single most ridiculous times for comic book costumes, with extra belts and thigh belts and extra pockets and this weird habit of wearing coats and trench coats over skin tight costumes. But for all that, I think my favorite costumes actually start off from that era. I'm a big fan, or was a big fan, of the X books, and I really enjoy costumes that have kind of a team theme and at least nod towards real clothing, although I think you can go way too far. I think there should be something kind of over the top in superhero costumes. So my favorite costumes are the early 90s X-Factor, when Havoc and Polaris took over the team from the original X-Men lineup. Peter David and Larry Stroman were putting the comic together at that time, and actually I think Larry Stroman's a guy whose work has really, really been underrated. He's kind of dropped out of comics, it seems, and I kind of miss his sort of unique stylization. There's a lot of energy and a really interesting line, and I miss his work a great deal. And in a similar vein, I'm also a big fan of Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's new X-Men costumes, the kind of the leather jackets with the big yellow X's on the front. Again, there's a little bit of that Frank Quitely ridiculousness, especially his penchant for female characters in very tall platform shoes, but there's still a nod towards kind of the leather jackets and some sort of a realistic fabric. And I think that mix works really, really well, having a little bit of superhero ridiculousness, but also kind of recognizing exactly how fabric and clothing works on something resembling a human body. Those were probably the single biggest inspiration for the X-Men costumes in the films, which actually I thought also were spectacular. Superhero costumes and films are really problematic. Usually they're latex or sculpted, which is kind of weird, and I thought that going for some sort of form-fitting leather in the X-Men movies was a really fantastic move, and I think more movies should imitate it. So those are my favorite costumes of all time, except maybe, of course, for the really iconic ones. You can say that a costume is most successful when it's most recognizable, in which case you'd really have to go with Batman and Superman costumes that you can recognize from really basic elements almost anywhere you see them. Well, that's my take, and thanks for listening.
Hey, yo, it's the mole portion of this show, our 75th show. I had to be on, and I'm here. Of course, I got Brett with me here, somebody to bounce some ideas off of. We're going to talk a little bit more about costumes. Try not to cover too much the same territory you guys covered last night, hopefully.
Well, basically, I'll tell you when you're crossing the line.
Well, you always do.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
which is all the time.
Pretty much. Let's start off, we'll just talk about favorite costumes. I mean, I don't think I'm going to be breaking any ground. I'm sure somebody did reference this, but The Flash.
Matt really likes Kid Flash.
Yeah, I was going to say Kid Flash as well, when it was, Kid Flash outfit. And I think obviously for me, I mean, Captain Marvel is a favorite character, and the costume there has some obvious similarities with the Flash, and we're talking about the Barry Allen Flash, that Silver Age Flash, obviously, and the Kid Flash, not the Mercurial Helmet Golden Age Flash,
which I mentioned because I thought it was silly.
Yeah, it was silly. I understand why they did it, but it was silly. So I mean that's. You know, among my favorite outfits, certainly those three. The first outfit that really made an impact on me, though, was when Spider-Man switched to the black outfit. I don't remember exactly what issue that was. I believe I was 9 or 10 years old, though. And I remember being at my friend Neil Ross's house. And he had gotten the issue. And, of course, it's a play on Amazing Fantasy 15, the cover, the pose. And I remember looking at that and being just fascinated. Like, that. I think that was the first time in my life when a comic book actually made an emotional impact on me, and it made me conflicted, made me feel some actual emotion, because until then I was just reading stories, you know, just having fun reading stories. But that was the first time that I think it impacted me. It could be something more because it could actually hit me emotionally, because I remember looking at that going, that's wrong. Like, it's wrong. It's not the right one, but I can't help but like it. And it created an emotion in me that obviously that's what comic books are striving for. So you have something to say there?
Well, I commented last night that in this case, Spider-Man is one of the very few characters who has two costumes that are both iconic, and people love both of them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, because the other one is a very iconic and a near-perfect costume. It's not one of my favorites. Personally, but I mean, it's a great costume, very colorful, very, you know, like you say, very iconic.
And there's lots you can do with it outside of just the comics.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But the black costume, I never liked it as much when it was on Venom. I never liked it as much as it was that very first time I saw it. And I was even more blown away, obviously, when you get inside and you had all the things it could do, like shoot the webs without web shooters and crawl on and off and look like other outfits and all that type of stuff, you know. So at the time, that was obviously a favorite. You know, you got some of I think Iron Man has had some favorite ones. Iron Man's had so many different looks over the years. I'll say the one I like actually is that silver and red one, kind of a blocky square look, but I just like that. I prefer that to the gold plated red uniform. How do you feel?
Well, I remember that you and I really liked, and I think it only occurred for like two or three issues, there was a blue and red armor that he had. I would love to go back and just find the armor, because I just remember thinking how awesome those colors were together.
Yeah, was that for his underwater one?
Or? I think it was in that. It was definitely in one of those periods where he had to go.
I think it was, who was it? It was Tom Michelinie, Morgan doing the maybe? Pencils. Yeah. And, pardon me?
Michelinie maybe as the writer?
Maybe. I thought it was actually after that. I thought it was Len, what was his name? Len Kaminsky or something like that after. You know, about this, I thought it was about, that was happening about the same time as we had the Reign of the Superman. You know, after the funeral for a friend, about that time. But yeah, and that was a really good looking costume. But yeah, I mean, as far as the ones that are more familiar, I like the silver kind of. I know it's a blockier look, but I just like that to me for that more than the gold and the red. I thought the silver and red just it looked more like what an Iron Man would look like, more and more iconic, or iconic as far as, I mean, actually probably more powerful.
Actually, I love the look of the Arno Stark Iron Man 2020, you know, with the extra little, you know, kind of gears on the outside. It's not terribly functional, you know, and the extra mean-looking looking faceplate. Oh, yeah. I love that look.
Yeah, it's a cool look. It's a cool look. Iron Man's obviously had you could change an Iron Man outfit, and it's, you know, it's not offensive to the character, to the look, or to the powers or anything, so... Just over the years, he's had a lot of different ones, and it's been a favorite. Wolverine, I'm just going to say, I prefer the kind of the orange-brown than the... I actually think that the yellow-blue Wolverine costume that he had when he first debuted, and he's had since, what, the mid-90s? Is that about the time they changed it, late 90s?
I think so, yeah.
It's a better-looking outfit. It's just... more illogical for the character and for the personality and the type of character he is, and also in real life. I mean, it's you know, very, it's a good looking costume, but it's very, very, I mean, why would a character like Wolverine, who works in the shadows, want something full of bright colors? And so for, on that, based on that particular, you know, kind of particular.
Well, a Wolverine itself is not yellow. A Wolverine itself is brown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just, the brown one also looked good, and the brown one fit everything, fit the character, and fit the, and that's the, when the character really took off in popularity, that's what he was wearing. And so, I mean, I kind of wish he would go back to that brown, I guess, I don't know, orange. I would call it orange, brown, orange?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's it. The yellow, the blue-yellow one is a great-looking costume that totally is awful for the character, as far as I'm concerned. And always kind of felt that. You know, one character who's, I think, is pretty awful, I gotta say, Black Lightning, when he first showed up. Remember, he just had a pair of Lone Ranger type white face mask, and it was attached to this massive afro. I mean, an afro just the size of Montana, and he would put that on, and it just looked ridiculous.
It looks ridiculous, but I have a soft spot in my heart for it. I love Black Lightning, and I love Black Lightning.
I love that.
Like, it would, because it was just so ludicrous.
It was.
That anybody would actually put on an afro.
Yeah, especially so huge. Well, I mean, to me, when I really realized how silly it was there was actually Saturday Night Live many years ago, and Sinbad was hosting, and there was a costume party, and he came as Black Lightning, and nobody knew who he was. And, because he was like, well, there's no other black superheroes for me to choose. And he had that on, and it just, you realize how ridiculous it would look in real life to do that. And it was just, it was funny to me. So, the Black Lightning one, same thing. I mean, but there's ones you have a soft spot for. I mean, I love the Luke Cage with the, you know, the blue tights and the yellow gold shirt and the chain, you know, and the,
oh yeah, open
collar and the chain belt,
yeah.
And the, I mean, let's not forget that headband thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
it was so 70s, and we talked about the disco era and the disco look to characters. And Luke Cage, he Power Man there, he had it.
Well, that's it. I mean, it was. I mean, he doesn't really wear a costume anymore. He hasn't worn a costume since the Cage series, really, when he was just in a pair of black jeans and a red shirt. And I know it looks ridiculous. I know it's that headband is stupid, but it's cool looking stupid, right? Like, it's not functional. Nobody would actually wear that. It's stupid looking. But on the other hand, you have to admit, like, the colors work well together, and the look works well together. It's like the sum is, you know, the whole is better than the sum of its parts, so to speak.
And I also have to say that at least it's not purple and green.
No.
Because every other costume is purple and green.
Yeah, there's a lot of purple and green out there. Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, you have costumes, and you have costumes that are slight takes on different things. I mean, you know, Hal Jordan's costume was great when he became, you know, the Green Lantern. And then you got Kyle Rayner coming up, and it's almost the exact same costume, but it looks stupid, largely because his mask
looks stupid.
His big, blocky mask just looks stupid. Especially since it was designed by a character who was a comic book artist. It just looked dumb. Again, sometimes it's just not functional, but you like it. I mean, I like Iron Fist's suit, but I don't know a single martial artist in the entire history of the world who's worn those ballerina slippers. You know, I mean, he'd be barefoot or nothing. You know, I mean, again, so when his costume got turned red, I thought that looked great. Better than the green. That was an awesome look. You know, Fantastic Four, for many years, they had that light blue. And to me, it just looked like they were wearing pajamas, and I thought it looked awful. And then when around the John Byrne time, it became like a dark blue. Not even navy, darker than that even. Because a really dark blue, almost black. And the white really got offset. And all of a sudden, the same design, generally almost the exact same design on the suits, just looked great to me. I thought that was one of the best upgrades. You know, it went from looking like a pair of pajamas to an actual uniform, as far as I was concerned. So, I don't know, what else, any comments on what I'm saying here? I'm trying to think if there's any more. I'm sure there's lots more, but...
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, costumes are all over the place. One of the questions that I did ask was, and I think you kind of touched on it, was who started out bad and got good?
Yeah, who started off bad and got good? Well, Daredevil.
Daredevil was the one that I gave right off the bat.
Yeah.
The yellow costume.
That yellow costume just looks stupid. And then, I mean, yeah, the one that it changed to was better. You remember when Booster Gold had, for a short time, went from his nice-looking costume to the one that was built in our own century, and it was just, again, high-tech, just stupid-looking?
The armor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was awful.
Oh, yeah, Keith mentioned the armor.
Oh, did he?
I actually felt like, for me, and I didn't get a chance to mention it, was Green Arrow. Mm-hmm. There's one thing I like. The look is fine. Like the Robin Hood look is fine with the hat, yeah. But I really loved it when he went to the Grell look with
the cowl hood is a way better look.
Stuff like that. Like it just fit him so much better, and I just preferred that look so much more for myself.
Yeah, absolutely. The Robin costume for many years was pretty ridiculous. It got better over the years when it became largely predominantly red with the long pant green instead of getting rid of the short shorts.
We talked about that.
You know, I mean, that's that obviously. But when Nightwing, I mean, first time I saw that Nightwing costume and it was Robin and he became that Nightwing, I thought that's a great costume. Somehow, even when it got the red look, it still didn't look bad though I prefer it with the blue. That was one of the best. That's certainly a great upgrade to me.
All right. Well, why don't we just end off with your favorite villain costume?
My favorite villain costume? That's an interesting one. The worst one ever was the Purple Man. That was bad.
But we talked about him because he's purple.
Well, that's it. He's just a purple man. Like a lot of costumes out there, it's like they're ridiculous, but you don't think of it. I mean, nobody thinks of Drax the Destroyer and thinks how damn ridiculous that is because he's Drax the Destroyer, right? So he can get away with it. I mean, certainly Dr. Doom's is a classic look. When it's drawn properly, to me, that's a look, that's a villain that looks frightening. When it's drawn properly, I think that would be the best. Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely go with Dr. Doom as being a best looking villain. Like I say, not really a costume, more, I mean, it's more than that, right? I mean, it's his personality. I think that's it. The Dr. Doom costume is Dr. Doom's personality. It represents who and what he is. I mean, there's no question. When you see Dr. Doom the first time, you know what that villain... You know that villain's motivation is personality right away. To me, that makes it a great costume. So, Dr. Doom for best villain. And I think we should wrap it up with that then.
Sounds good.
Hey guys, it's one third of the All Mother from the Hangout at Charming Red. I hear you guys are celebrating your 75th episode, and that's awesome. You know, my one regret after guest hosting that was that I was still not able to meet Mo. Hopefully that can be fixed before episode 150. That and fixing the comic taste of my arch nemesis, Cub Reporter K. In the meantime, if you're talking about costumes, the best has to be Barbara Gordon's Batgirl. It's flattering, full covering, and serves its purpose well with a utility belt and plating. I mean, I love She-Hulk too, but who would really wear a swimsuit into battle? Congrats again on 75 episodes, guys.
It is now time for our regular feature of the WeViews. So, Keith, what are we doing?
Here I come to save the day.
We are saving you from bad comics.
Yay. All right, let's see now. What should we do to start?
Snake format.
Everybody loves snake format. No, you know what? Because Mo's not here, and Mo always does the snake format, so I will just choose. So, Matt, Danger Girl Trinity, number one.
All right. You know, it's funny, because I've never read any Danger Girl before. But I thought this was really, it was really kind of cool. I'll say up front, it's really not my kind of book. Like, it's actually, I was thinking about this as I was reading it. It's really mom's kind of book, Jessica's kind of book. It seems like just a lot of fun, sort of light. You know, when I read about spies or spy, especially spy women, I kind of want it to be a little grittier, a little darker. But that's just my thing. But, you know, I thought it was pretty well written and really well drawn. And not having ever read anything about Danger Girl before, I got it. Like, I got the characters. I got their motivations. I might actually read the next issue. I will say, though, I was a little disturbed that Abby, and this is a spoiler, but that within the first couple pages, she punched a monkey, which kind of made me a little sad. But yeah, it was pretty good. Not usually my thing, but I might follow up on it.
All right. Well, I will go next. Now, I have read virtually every issue of Danger Girl. It is one of my guilty pleasures. This actually, I thought, was the best Danger Girl or issue that I have read since J. Scott Campbell actually left the book, however many moons ago he did that. There's so many times when I read Danger Girl and I just want it to be what it used to be, and I think that this is a little closer to that. It's got a great sense of fun. It's, you know, it is a total cheesecake guilty pleasure book, but I mean, I happen to be a fan of Indiana Jones, and I happen to be a fan of James Bond. So, you know, you mash those up with hot women, and really, I mean, you don't go too wrong for me. But I like this one, so I'll definitely keep reading it. Keith?
I would say 2/3 of the book, I would agree with you. The book's kind of broken up into three parts, three different artists, same writer. And the first two chapters are really liked. The third one I thought kind of went a bit wonky. The first one's kind of the Indiana Jones type story. The second one, the more kind of traditional spy, Black Widow kind of James Bond kind of thing. And I really like both of those. I actually hadn't read much Danger Girl since the Scott Campbell stuff, aside from, I think, we've reviewed a number one on here before. I'm curious to try a second issue to see kind of how these stories weave together. I assume now that Trinity is, that they may not weave together. Maybe it's called Trinity because it will be three separate stories, kind of serial format for the run. So I'm engaged enough to come back for a second issue.
Is that third character not one of the originals?
Did I
read that somewhere?
Yeah, I'm pretty... Yeah, I don't think she is. She's the sister of one of the originals.
Oh, okay.
But not specifically one of the originals.
Yeah. I mean, I will agree that I thought the second bit was definitely the most entertaining for me, but it's also the closest to the kind of stuff I would read otherwise. I didn't mind the third part, but, you know, it was just a first issue.
And Ham, do we know how long this run is? Is it a set run?
I think it's four. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough. The Trinity is a four-issue miniseries.
Trinity number one of four. That is an odd.
All right, Matt. Now that we're moving on, Witchblade, Night of the Outlaws, Something of the Outlaws?
Day of the Outlaws.
Day of the Outlaws. I was close. It was like a zombie thing.
Right. Okay, and so here's another one. This is revealing a lot about my reading habits. I have never read a Witchblade comic ever. But I live in the world, so like I know enough about Witchblade that I don't need. I'm like, who? What? So, you know, I get she's Sarah Pacini. She's got this Witchblade, whatever. So I just went into this assuming that this was sort of like a tale of times past, and what it seemed to be more is that it's more like an Elseworlds, and that kind of was a big letdown for me. And I went in with some pretty high expectations because the writer is Joshua Hale Fialkov, and I don't remember who the artist is.
Nelson Blake.
Yeah, and the art was great, and I will say that it actually made me laugh out loud a couple times, which I'm not normally apt to do. But yeah, it just sort of felt like when I got to the end, I just didn't really see the point of it. And it's a one shot and just sort of left off, I don't know. It was really short for a one shot too. It's like it was only 20 pages or 22 pages for, you know, for a part of a bigger story that seems fine, but when you do a one shot I usually expect like a 38 or a 48 or something.
Yeah, there was a point where I actually thought that this was a digital only release. Because I looked at it and then I saw it on Comixology and I noticed that it was $3.99 and I'm like, wow, that's really a lot of money for a very little story. Right. There, because there is not very much story going on in this book. I've only read a few Witchblade stories overall. I'm not a fan of the character going in. But, you know, one of the things... I'll admit, you know, like, every time I see Joshua Hale Fialkov's name, there's this part of me that thinks, oh, okay, good, you know, here's an up-and-coming writer, so I'm really expecting something out of this. The one thing that I will say from my point of view is that I feel that Joshua Hale Fialkov is one of the single worst writers of dialogue in comic books today. Every time he writes dialogue, especially out of his current time frame, it always sounds like he's writing dialogue for the 2000s.
Oh, and, yeah, no question.
You know, and 2000s dialogue in Westerns and 2000s dialogue in iVampire didn't work for me, period. So I don't know why I keep getting excited for seeing his name, because I haven't liked anything by him yet. But, and this one is certainly no different. It's a Witchblade comic, and I don't see why anybody would buy it. Keith?
Well, I liked it. It is a bit thin as far as a one-shot goes. It's no pun intended for a Western book. It's a one-trick pony. There's not a whole lot to the story, but I was intrigued by a bit of what they were saying of you know, her relationship to the town, and then the darkness turns up. I don't know enough of the background to know whether it's alternate universe or just that there's always been a Witchblade and there's always been darkness, which kind of was my assumption of it. I wouldn't call it a terribly memorable story. I enjoyed it. It was what it was, and it had a couple of giggle moments. And then it draws itself to a conclusion, and I don't have to make a decision of whether I'm coming back or not.
That is one positive to it. Yeah, there's no questions about it.
No choices need to be made following the reading of this book. But I thought there was some neat storytelling in the art. I thought there was some interesting layouts that they did, for sure.
The art is nice. There is no question about it.
Yeah, I like the art, except there was one, the last double page spread, I thought the art just fell apart. Like, it just felt like they were, I don't know, wasn't enough detail for the amount of space they were taking up.
All right, Matt, House of Golden Bones.
I don't really have much to say about this except, what? Like, I know it has something to do with music, and I don't know this band, and I don't know the guy who's writing it, so maybe you guys want to fill me in a little bit on that, but... Well,
yeah, I know a little bit more about it than you do, so in that regard.
Yeah, go ahead then. Maybe you can, and then I can.
I don't think it'll help. I mean, Corey Taylor is the lead singer, basically the musical genius behind Slipknot and Stone Sour. Stone Sour, I much prefer, but so, and then he decided to get into writing comic books. I mean. It seems like every musician is at some point now is getting into writing comic books, but...
Yeah, but I don't know how much writing there was here. Like, so, there was no story. And, I felt like it was this sort of dream sequence that no one ever woke up out of. It did feel sort of like a very, very, very pale imitation of The Wall. So I get this sort of, like, and not in storyline, but, like, in feel. So I get the kind of narrative that comes from, like, you've written an album and you want to put it on the paper. But I just didn't get it. I thought the art was okay. I did like the image. The first time you see the dark twin, that's a pretty cool image. But past that, it sort of didn't make any sense to me.
I think the problem for me was that it actually struck me as really pretentious. Like, it was this constant just jibber-jabber, like, look at me, I'm writing a comic book. Look at me, I'm trying to sound really intelligent and really cool, been writing this comic book.
There was one line of dialogue, like, well, I guess I'll know if I open my eyes, or something like that. I'm like, who would say that? Like, it's exactly that. It felt very too self-aware in a way.
Yeah, there's a part of me that you know, has whatever interest I have in Corey Taylor. There's this part of me that says, well, maybe it will get better. But then there's this also just this part of me that says, I just don't think I have the time to read through all the pompous dialogue to hope that it gets better. And so I think that's probably the line that I see. If this was a one shot, I'd be fine. But that's kind of the line where I sit, where I probably won't be back because I just can't imagine wanting to read the rest of it. Keith?
I woke up slowly, not really ready to open my eyes. I was in no hurry to rush them into service. Well, the only way to get any answers is to open my eyes.
Yep.
Wow. I really do not like this thing. I didn't even like the art. I won't even give it that. There's some if they were gonna be non-realistic with the art, go further with it. If it's a it's too realistic to be a dream world, and it's not realistic enough to be realism. So I don't know what direction they were going, and then it just goes off on this, you know, left turn with the evil twin that totally didn't work for me, and it's all spooky, and I guess that's where the tracks change if you play the album with it. But you play the album with Wizard of Oz just to see if it'll turn out rather than read this comic.
Yeah, you're probably much better off just going with the Wizard of Oz anyway.
What you could do actually is just watch Wizard of Oz.
Yep.
And save yourself a lot of time.
All right, Dark Shadows, year one, Matt.
I love that I have to go first every time. This is the burden of being the guest host, I guess.
It's just the way that I chose it.
Yeah, that's fine. I will say, okay, so Dark Shadows, year one. This was written by somebody we know too, wasn't it?
Mark Andreyko.
Yes, Mark Andreyko. So I'm a fairly big fan of his. And I was extremely relieved to see that this book from Dynamite was not based on the movie, the recent movie, but instead is based on the television show, the original, because the movie was really, really heinous. I actually kind of like this. You know, I don't know a whole lot about the original story. I've watched a few episodes, but I mean, so long ago that it's I may as well have never seen it. But there was something kind of creepy about the whole thing. And so, you know, it's for those who don't know, you know, Dark Shadows is basically this soap opera that was on television forever. And it was like a real, gothic type soap opera that involved this guy, Barnabas Collins, and he was a vampire, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And so he, you know, but he has an origin and this is his origin. But this is basically about his betrothal to this witch, and she is creepy. And I think the art that was done Villanova, Mr. Villanova, was I think really really meshed well with the original television show. Like nice, and there was a nice color palette. I don't know that I'm so interested in the characters that I might come back, but I did enjoy the issue itself more than I thought I would.
I only have a cursory interest in Dark Shadows. I haven't actually seen any of the TV show, but I have seen the movie and I enjoyed the movie.
Ooh.
But that's probably just because I haven't seen any of the TV show. So, I mean, it's hard for me to say. For me, having that be my only, you know, knowledge of the story, I actually found that this kind of fit within that because I expect different things out of it. No question about that. You know, I agree with your review, Matt. I think that it's a pretty good book. I'm not 100% sure that I'm interested enough to want to come back, but I think that the story itself is engaging, and for a fan of Dark Shadows, I can certainly see that there is something there for them. Keith?
I've never seen a single episode of the TV series, and I think I made it 20 minutes into the movie before the bleeding from my eyes got to be too much. I kind of enjoyed this. The art fit well with the story. It's not super clean. It's kind of rough and tumble art. One thing I really liked about it, and it was a complaint I had about one of the other Dynamite Year Ones that we had recently, was that this is authentically a Year One. It starts from the beginning of the story, and really shows us who Barnabas Collins is, shows his world, how he relates to other people, introduces a bit of a supporting cast. I have no idea, because I have no connection to these characters. There's a bit more jeopardy in the story because I don't know which ones make it out. Aside from Barnabas Collins, I have no idea which characters of these will continue on to be in the series, in the TV story. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I'm drawn enough to try another issue. I didn't actually check to see how long the story of this book is.
I think it's four again. But.
If it's four, I might be tempted. If it's like the Green Hornet and it's eight, or was it Green Hornet or was that Shadow? Shadow is eight.
Shadow, yeah.
I'm not sure I'm in for that kind of investment. This might be worth reading in a trade. And maybe actually after that I'd be interested enough to go back and find some of the TV shows.
All right. Our last review of the week, Ted McKeever's Miniature Jesus. Matt.
This was from Image Comics, five-issue miniseries starting this week. And, I have to say that the thing that really struck me about it was the art more. And I know Ted McKeever's both a writer and an artist, but I think that the art here is really phenomenal. It's black and white, really tight pencil and ink, I guess. And beautiful, beautiful light and dark, cross hatching, gorgeous rendering. I was really, really impressed with the art. I think it's beautiful. The story, I thought, this out of all the books we reviewed this week, this is my favorite. But its subject matter is something I'm much more interested in, too, so it has that advantage. There were some problems. I felt the monologue was a little bit overwhelming, a little bit too dramatic. But it's sort of this introspective, thoughtful, sort of religious book. But there was still a moment, and I won't spoil it for people who I would suggest pick it up. But the last like three pages, I just thought were absolutely fantastic. And there's no question that I'll be coming back to read the second issue for sure.
Well, I always, I'm a huge fan of Ted McKeever's work, and I think that the one thing I will say about the art in this case is that it's really maturing. Like, it's a really mature art style from Ted McKeever because Mondo was completely different. Like, it wasn't very tight, it was really loose, but it fit the style. And this fits the book perfectly. For me, for the story, I really didn't know what to expect coming in for this. Now, the truth is that, I think on the first or second page, there's a dead cat that talks to him. And so for me, that's Ted McKeever. That's what I expect. So, I was kind of hooked right with that. But from the perspective of Jesus, for me, that's one of those cases where I'm just like, how religious am I willing to read in a book? Obviously, as an atheist, I don't see the there's questions there for me. So I loved the last three pages. I thought that they were fantastic as well. And I don't know where this one's going. It could go anywhere. And that's the great thing about Ted McKeever. So for me, totally into this one. Keith?
He's really brought a whole new style to this book. I've read McKeever for close to 20 years, and it's almost like Mike Zulie's stuff. It's a very different style than that McKeever's done. And there's some clunky stuff in the dialogue. McKeever's ideas have always been bigger than the words on the page. But his ideas are always so incredible. I was I'll give away that I was so excited about when I heard about this book because I saw the ad in an Image comic about 2 months ago that I texted Brett immediately and said, did you know there's a new Ted McKeever comic coming? So I was predisposed to enjoy this book, and I really did enjoy it. And just because, you know, just because I'm talking now, check out Comixology and see the Ted McKeever library books. The hardcovers in print are like $25-$30 or something. They're like $4 on Comixology, and they've got Metropol, Eddy Current, and Transit. So there's like, you know, it's like hundreds of pages.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, it's like sick.
400 or 500 pages. It's ridiculous how the deal that these are. And when you get those and get Miniature Jesus while you're at it, really, really love this book. Absolutely top of the week.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that we're, an atheist, a Buddhist, and a Jew sitting here reviewing Miniature Jesus. But it's interesting because because Jesus is this other thing to me. I can read this book and I find it really fascinating. So
yeah, and I think we're all
the kind of emotional investment in the symbology that other people might. So that might be a deterrent for some people, but I don't know. I mean, those last three pages, I hate to be a tease about it, but that was, especially that last page, that was pretty cool.
It was very cool.
That's the title of the next time you guest host Nomad, an atheist, a Buddhist, and a Jew walk into a podcast.
One ducks. Oh, wait, that doesn't work. All right. Well, it's time to go out. So let's see now. Firstly, if you want to reach us, comics@wetalkpodcast.com. That's comics plural. We are friends of the Comics Podcast Network. Otherwise, let's see now. Oh, I don't know. Keith, why don't you throw us some information?
Hey, you can follow me on Twitter, Cub Reporter K, and we will be at the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo, the weekend of the 26th, 27th, 28th of April. Follow us on Twitter because I do expect that at some point we'll try to do a tweet up. There are quite a few Twitter followers that Twitter pals that I have that will be at the show as well. The show is sold out, so if you got your tickets, we'll see you there. And if you did not get your tickets, we'll see you there next year. Matt?
I am found on Twitter at Photocub, FOTOCUB. And I just want to, remind people to check out Comicosity, especially next weekend, because not only will there be some Calgary Expo coverage from Keith, but is hopefully some good C2E2, that's the Chicago Entertainment and Comics Expo, I think, coverage, which is the exact same weekend. So we're double-headering it for you. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And, of course, if anyone's going to be at C2E22 and wants to meet up, please do a tweet out or just find me on Twitter, and I'd love to meet some people. I did that last year, and it was really cool to get to see some people face-to-face. I still think it's really weird to call people that I only talk to on Twitter by their real names, so forgive me if I just use your handle. That's just the way it's going to be. But in the meantime, check out Comicosity. We've had some great interviews go up recently. We just finished doing a sales analysis of March numbers for Marvel, DC, and Independence. And, again, thanks so much for having me on, guys. I love it. It's one of the proudest things that Aaron and I have is that we're associated with you guys.
Oh, shucks. That's so nice.
Thanks for being part of our 75th anniversary episode.
That's right. The big 75th anniversary, because we talk comics. But, all right, I am Brett, B-R-E-T-T underscore we talk, and absolutely at the expo, I think we'll be doing a lot of crazy stuff. I don't even know who we're going to wind up interviewing, but I know there'll be a bunch of interviews coming out from that, so it's getting interesting, getting close, and I am quite excited about it now. So I'm happy about that. But otherwise, I think that, you know, thanks to Matt for coming on. Thanks to Comicosity for the sponsorship. Thanks to our buddy Chris Duker there, the Duke of Geek, of course, as Mo would say, and Comic Book Therapy. And, of course, Mo and Chris. That's Mo underscore Wheat underscore WeTalk and Chris underscore WeTalk. Those are easy to remember. But for now, I guess we're OUT.
Welcome to Comic Book Attractions, the part of the show where I remind you of comic book films, both good and bad, old and new, that should be watched and enjoyed for what they are. This week, I got a doozy. I gotta say, a lot of these I've been really gritting my teeth through. This one I love, but it does suffer from a fatal flaw, which I'll get to. I am talking about 1996's The Phantom, starring Billy Zane. I promised myself early on that I'd stick to comic book films, and technically this doesn't qualify. I gave Mo a hard time on another podcast about wanting me to do Dick Tracy, which is technically a comic strip, and so is this. I guess I'm broadening out, and I'm starting to realize, even if I do comic strips, there are enough comic book films and films based on comic strips that I never have to watch Garfield, which basically was my entire point on this. The Phantom, I think, is the closest we'll ever get to an Indiana Jones-type high road to adventure film outside of Indiana Jones we'll ever get. I mean, the action, the camp, this is an extremely fun film. Out of the fact that Billy Zane lobbied for this role, he exercised, he refused to wear a Batman-type padded suit. He is in shape. The cast in this, spectacular. You have Treat Williams, you have Christy Swanson, Catherine Zeta-Jones, the list just goes on. All actors who understand camp. Action, spectacular, really, really a fun film. But I have to go right to the fatal flaw. I like this film, but at no point in time does the fact that our star is wearing a grape outfit leave my mind. I mean, this is a film where our hero and his love interest jump from a moving, crashing plane onto a gallop of horse and really don't even stop to catch their breath. This is amazing. Yet, the entire scene, I'm thinking, why doesn't somebody point out he's wearing purple? It really hurts the film. A lot of people love the character of the Phantom, and I don't completely understand why. Sergio Leone, from The Good, the Bad, and Ugly, wanted to make a Phantom film, and I don't understand why. He never got it done, I understand that. He's been put in multiple cartoons. He's had a television show. He's had a sci-fi miniseries. What the hell? Why does this character ring with some people? He wears a purple suit. I mean, I can't think of a worse costume. A truly bad costume. This guy starred in a cartoon show with Flash Gordon and a magician, and you still wondered who the idiot in the purple costume was. But this is a good film. I really like it. I'm glad after initial box office failure, it's gained some sort of cult status. It was really quite entertaining. Originally supposed to be directed by Joe Dante, he remained a producer, but he didn't get to actually direct. I would have loved to see that film. I mean, this is the man who did Gremlins. I think that would have been a lot of fun. Bruce Campbell was up for the part. To see his take would have been wonderful, but I really do think they got the right guy with Billy Zane. I mean, he lobbied for this part. He bulked up. He looks great, despite the fact that it's purple. He's in a purple suit. Really, really buff. Let's just listen to the trailer here.
Just take a look around. Darkness rules the earth.
In a dangerous world.
Governments crumble. Chaos reigns.
In a treacherous time.
There is opportunity in chaos.
Evil is a fact.
We shall succeed where they have failed.
Drax is on a quest for a supernatural power.
They know far too much.
And courage.
Stop them. You're the only one who can.
Is a phantom.
Who was that guy?
Somebody I already killed.
There are some who say he is only a myth. Soon they will discover the Phantom is real.
This film was written by Jeffrey Brohm, who also wrote Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Indiana Jones, of course, also inspired by film serials, of which The Phantom was one. So really, you can say they're ripping off each other. Directed by Simon Winsor, who, let's just say, his biggest film ever was Free Willy. He did direct Guilty Pleasure of Mine, a Harley Davidson, and The Marlboro Man, but it definitely is a guilty pleasure. He didn't go on to do, didn't have a huge movie career, but an interesting one. Really, although I do like this film, The Phantom has never resonated with me, and neither has any of Lee Falk's creations, really. I would really like to Mandrake the Magician more, but really don't. But I haven't gone back yet and watched the serials for The Phantom or Mandrake the Magician. So maybe that's what I have to do. I've read some of the comic strips. Once again, I just keep thinking, why is this idiot in the purple suit? Let me know what you think. Chris_WeTalk. You can tell me, did the purple suit wreck this movie for you? Or, did you enjoy it in spite of it? I'd really like to know, is this a fatal flaw? Can this character be saved? And what do people see in this character, despite the really silly costume? But until next time, Chris, OUT.